vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the July 7th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: jet fuel prices are down 40% from their peak in April amid the Iran war, but analysts say airfares aren't likely to follow as long as travelers keep paying up. Davos founder Klaus Schwab is trying to make a comeback at the World Economic Forum after resigning as chair last year amid a probe into misconduct allegations. Microsoft said it would cut some 3,200 jobs from its Xbox video games division as the company restructures the struggling business. Samsung projected a 19-fold surge in second quarter operating profit, signaling that its record earnings streak is set to continue amid the AI boom and red-hot demand for chips. Large U.S. banks have been exploring an acquisition that could allow them to get around one of the laws they hate the most, the limits on fees they earn on debit card transactions. Shares of London-listed EasyJet soared nearly 10% after the budget carrier said it had agreed to a $19 billion takeover by Castle Lake. Toyota will spend $3.6 billion to bring production of its Tacoma pickup back to the U.S. from Mexico by 2030. Walmart is cutting prices on thousands of items to help customers with affordability after years of inflation. SK Hynix, a South Korean chip maker, kicked off the process for a U.S. listing that seeks to raise $28 billion in fresh capital. U.S. stocks rose with the Dow, S&P 500, and NASDAQ, gaining 0.3%, 0.7%, and 1.1% respectively. Comcast Sky has agreed to buy ITV's television business for up to about $2.14 billion, combining two of the UK's best-known media brands. SpaceX is expected to join the NASDAQ 100 on Tuesday, and investors holding some funds tied to the index will end up exposed. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. Trump confirmed that he called FIFA's president and asked him to review U.S. striker Filarin Balagan's one-game World Cup suspension, a move that set off an uproar among soccer fans across the globe. Democratic Party leaders and close allies urged Graham Platner to quit the main Senate race after a woman he had been romantically involved with alleged that he sexually assaulted her, an allegation he denied. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps fired missiles at two commercial ships near the Strait of Hormuz, according to a senior U.S. official. marking a major escalation that threatens to complicate negotiations to end the war. Prosecutors seeking the death penalty in the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk began laying out their evidence as they push for a murder trial. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for lethal autonomous weapons to be banned. Russia's latest missile attack on Kyiv exposed a grim reality. Ukraine has virtually run out of Patriot interceptors that stop ballistic missiles. China's military said it test-launched a long-range ballistic missile from a nuclear submarine, a rare display of advanced capabilities that set off concerns from the U.S.'s regional allies. American allies are rushing to find workarounds for the weapons and forces the U.S. told other NATO members they could no longer rely on in a crisis. Netanyahu's bid to survive as Israel's prime minister is running up against support for a political newcomer, a former general who lost his son in the Gaza war. The picture on today's front page takes place in a war-torn area where a woman is cuddling her infant child. And that caption reads, "A woman held her daughter in the aftermath of a Russian ballistic missile strike Monday in Kyiv that killed at least 12 people." The article, "Ukraine's Missile Shortage Imperils Kyiv. Moscow's Barrages Against the Capital Exploit Global Lack of Patriot Interceptors," by Anastasia Malenko and Alistair McDonald. Kyiv, Ukraine. Russia's latest missile strike on the Ukrainian capital, which killed at least 12 people and wounded close to 50, has exposed a grim reality. Ukraine has virtually run out of Patriot interceptors that stop ballistic missiles. Ukraine was unable to intercept any of the 23 Russian ballistic missiles that crashed into Kyiv area early Monday. Russia's nearly unimpeded strikes are the consequence of a global dearth of interceptors for the U.S.-made Patriot anti-missile system, a shortage compounded by this year's U.S.-led war with Iran. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to ask Western countries to send more of their own scarce supply of interceptors when he attends the North Atlantic Treaty Organization summit in Ankara this week. Zelensky called on the U.S. to give higher priority to Ukraine's urgent missile defense needs. Missiles for patriots are a priority, and of course we understand that the political will of the United States would certainly be enough to make up for the patriot shortage. But so far, there is not enough of that support, he said on Sunday evening, hours before Russia's latest barrage. Another headline, Belgium ends U.S. run for the World Cup. And there's a picture of a U.S. player with his hands on his head in horror. And that caption reads, "Too late." U.S. goalkeeper Matt Fries reacts as Belgium celebrates a goal at the World Cup soccer match in Seattle Monday. And there's another picture where Charles de Ketterle scored two goals in the first half in Belgium's 4-1 win over the U.S. in the round of 16. The article, Falarin Balagan returned to the lineup, but he couldn't carry the Americans to the quarterfinals in a 4-1 defeat, by Joshua Robinson and Andrew Beaton, Seattle. The U.S. national team came into this World Cup with every conceivable home advantage. The Americans enjoyed automatic qualification as co-host. They encountered raucous, star-spangled crowds wherever they went, and when necessary, they could count on a game-changing assist from the Oval Office. Even after presidential intervention helped the team's top scorer back into the lineup, however, the U.S. couldn't overcome its latest challenge on the field, the country of Belgium, the fifth-ranked team in Europe. On Monday evening, the Belgium Red Devils swept into Seattle and brought the American World Cup campaign to an untimely end with a 4-1 defeat in the round of 16. The U.S. had been playing to reach its first World Cup quarterfinal since 2002, but that detail was easily forgotten over the previous 24 hours as a stunning series of events placed the U.S. at the center of a global soccer firestorm. American striker Falarin Balagan had seen his suspension for an earlier red card lifted on Sunday after President Trump spoke with FIFA boss Gianni Infantino, prompting outrage and astonishment from a Belgium team that argued the U.S. was being given preferential treatment. FIFA, soccer's world governing body, denied a Belgium appeal on Monday morning, and by kickoff later that afternoon, Balagan was walking out of the tunnel alongside his teammates. U.S. supporters gave him the loudest reception of any player when he was introduced, while the Belgium fans booed. Some even waved red cards in the air. Unfortunately for the Americans, that was one of the rare occasions that Balagan electrified the crowd. He had no goals and just 3 shots. His greatest contribution was drawing the foul that led to Balik Tillman's free kick goal to make it 1-1 in the first half. That proved to be the last gasp for the American attack. 2 minutes after they tied the game, Charles de Ketterle headed home his second goal of the match to put the Belgians back on top. Other articles from the front page follow. Changing face of war poses new test for military powers. A Ukrainian serviceman at a command center operates a mid-range drone during a flight toward Russian positions. Flexibility is key for drones. AI and cheap missiles upend how battles are waged, by Yaroslav Trofimov. The way wars are fought is changing fast as new technologies upend military doctrines on everything from procurement to executing operations. But just how radical will this transformation be in years to come? And are the hundreds of billions of dollars being invested by the U.S., its allies and rivals, in new tanks, planes, and warships going to become the equivalent of buying horses and arrows on the eve of machine guns and howitzers? The war between Russia and Ukraine was initially dismissed by many Western military leaders as a conflict that didn't hold many lessons for them, because the U.S. and allies, should they fight, would have air superiority and powerful precision munitions for a quick, devastating blow. The failure of the U.S. and Israel to inflict a strategic defeat on a middle power like a run, after expending a large share of these precision munitions, has undermined that notion. Drone-centered warfare, with it the accessibility of abundant, cheap precision munitions, is here to stay. So is the spread of other capabilities, such as long-range ballistic and cruise missiles, that used to be the preserve of major powers, and even for them were too expensive for mass use. Meanwhile, the development of autonomous systems guided by artificial intelligence heralds an even more momentous turn. In the wars of today, what used to be the safe rear hundreds of miles away from the front line is now contested, be it at U.S. bases in the Persian Gulf or Russian military installations far from Ukraine. The proliferation of cheap sensors has also made any massed maneuver, such as an armed thrust akin to the U.S. assault on Iraq in 2003, much more difficult because any concentration of troops can be spotted quickly and attacked well before reaching the battlefield. In defense ministries and military headquarters around the world, everyone is paying attention and trying to figure out what lessons to draw. The character of warfare is changing fundamentally, said General Carsten Brewer, Germany's chief of defense. Armed forces must be able to adapt faster, integrate new technologies, and learn at speed. If we fail to adapt, we will not be able to prevail. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Jet fuel cost drop brings no relief for flyers. Carriers are rushing to bring back flights trimmed during oil's surge. By Allison Sider. Airlines are finally getting some relief at the jet fuel pump. Flyers may not share in the savings, though. Jet fuel prices doubled in the weeks after the Iran war started, and carriers raised fares to keep up. Now fuel prices are down 40% from their peak in April, but analysts say fares aren't likely to follow because travelers keep paying up. Resilient travel demand and restrained supply, especially with the one-time discount leader Spirit Airlines out of the picture, are bolstering airline executives' confidence. I'm actually very bullish that the industry will retain a much higher percent of the fare increases than would be typical historically, Southwest Airlines chief executive Bob Jordan said at an investor conference in late May. Obviously, you hate to see somebody go out of business, but with Spirit out of business, I think that helps that environment, he said. Airline shares have been on a tear in recent weeks, trading higher with each downward move in the price of crude oil. Delta Airlines, the industry's profit leader, and United Airlines both hit record highs in late June. American Airlines stock rose more than 30% over the past month. Founder plots return to Davos Forum by Emily Glazer. Klaus Schwab is trying to make a comeback at the World Economic Forum. The 88-year-old founder recently sent letters to board members with a list of demands, legal threats, and a request for an advisory role that would give him a say in appointing the forum's future leadership, according to documents viewed by the Wall Street Journal. Schwab resigned as chair of the forum, which hosts an annual meeting in January in Davos, Switzerland, last year after a public clash with the board for its opening of an investigation into a whistleblower's allegations of misconduct. A journal investigation in 2024 uncovered evidence of a toxic culture at the forum for women and black employees. Schwab denied any wrongdoing. Schwab's justification is anchored in part on the forum last year saying it found no material wrongdoing in a public statement after the investigation into the complaints of unauthorized spending and inappropriate treatment of female staffers. Documents reviewed by the journal show that the August 2025 statement was at odds with findings that were privately shared with the board by lawyers conducting the probe. Those include instances of discrimination and bullying, misuse of corporate funds, and breaches of data integrity. Iran war has oil-rich Alaska in pain over $9 gas. Trump agenda poised to boost industry, but Alaskans face high prices at pump. By Benoit Morin. Dillingham, Alaska. John Stelling has just cranked the digits of his fuel pump to $9.10 at his gas station in this remote Alaskan community when he realized he had a problem. Could he push the meter to $10 if he had to? Not sure if it'll handle those, he said, of double-digit fuel prices. In rural Alaska, the war with Iran has led to some of the highest fuel prices in the nation. Remote towns and villages aren't connected to the road system, so they pay hefty premiums to procure gasoline, heating oil, and diesel for cranking out electricity. Fuel typically arrives by barge in the summer when ice clears from waterways. The last barge to unload sets the price until the next delivery, months away. Many communities had no choice this year but to place their orders in the spring, just as the Iran war sent prices soaring. That means that even if the U.S. and Iran reach a peace deal and the Strait of Hormuz reopens permanently, rural Alaskans will be stuck with exorbitant energy prices long after they have come down for the rest of the country. The small scale of rural Alaska works against them. The distances work against them. Governor Mike Dunleavy said in an interview, it could end up being a tough fall and winter. Moving in, kids in 20s are living back home. By Rebecca Pisciotto and Nicholas G. Miller. Samantha Stobo was fresh off a breakup and unable to afford her Manhattan two-bedroom alone. So the 29-year-old decided to move in with her mom in Miami until she could get back on her feet. She told herself it would only take a few months. Now 33 years old, Stobo has no plans to move out. I thought it was going to be temporary, Stobo said, but it's been 3 years now and I love it. Living at home as a 20-something was once viewed as a failure to launch and even a source of embarrassment. That's no longer the case, as it is now often viewed as a sign of financial prudence and for some, a long-term prospect. Chronically high living costs are helping reshape the milestone of early adulthood in America. The national median home price hovers around $400,000. Rents are at record highs in cities across the U.S., and many recent college graduates are saddled with tens of thousands of dollars in student debt. Even though some of these young adults pay their folks' rent, it tends to be well below the cost of living on their own. Iran turns funeral into message for world. Mourning Khomeini, Tehran threatens Trump and trolls Turkey, Saudi Arabia. By Salah El-Batadi and Benoit Falcon. A crowd of mourners joined the funeral procession Monday for the body of Ali Khamenei, one of the biggest moments in a week of events that were part eulogy for the former supreme leader killed at the start of the Iran war, and part of an elaborately managed exercise in political messaging to the country's allies and enemies. Iranian authorities say 11 million people took public transportation to attend the memorial that began on Saturday to honor Khamenei, who was killed with several relatives in the first wave of Israeli and U.S. airstrikes on Tehran more than 4 months ago. Participants belted a picture of President Trump with stones, while others held a banner that said, "We will kill Trump," in Farsi and English, according to footage circulated on Iranian state media. Iran's new leaders got the multi-day event off to an argumentative start. Foreign delegations were greeted with what appeared to be targeted verses from the Quran as they arrived Friday to pay homage to the slain leader, whose body lay in state at Tehran's Grand Masala. The Iran-backed Lebanese militia Hezbollah, which joined in the war by attacking Israel, was greeted with a verse framing military setbacks as part of a divine cycle in which God chooses martyrs and reveals the faithful. A delegation from the Palestinian militia Hamas received a verse praising believers who have remained true to the covenant they made with God. Iran's backing helped Hamas build up its forces before launching the deadly October 7, 2023 attack on Israel that set off 3 years of war. The delegation from Saudi Arabia, which hosts U.S. bases and hit Iranian targets during the war, got a different message. The Iranians picked a quote referring to the Battle of Badr, in which the Prophet Muhammad's followers defeated a much larger force through what was interpreted as divine intervention. "There has already been a sign for you in the two armies that met," the verse said. "One was fighting in the cause of Allah and the other of disbelievers." Tehran also scolded the Turkish delegation for Ankara's neutrality during the war. "Believers who stay at home," their verse said, "are not equal to those who strive in the cause of Allah." On Monday, Iranian television broadcast mourners walking alongside Khamenei's coffin and those of several slain relatives. The processions are meant to confer renewed legitimacy on Khamenei's worldview and show that a large constituency in Iran remains mobilized behind it. An Iran-focused fellow at the Center for International Policy said, "Iran is signaling that it will not back down." IRGC fires missiles at ships in Strait, by Shelby Holliday and Rebecca Feng. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps fired missiles at two commercial ships near the Strait of Hormuz early Tuesday, according to a senior U.S. official, marking an escalation that threatens to complicate negotiations to end the U.S.-Iran war. "Our missiles and drones are ready to fire at you," the Revolutionary Guard warned ships via maritime radio over the weekend, according to a recording shared with the Wall Street Journal. The move to attack ships with missiles amid talks to end the war demonstrates the power wielded by the Revolutionary Guard, which has been at odds with more moderate voices in the Iranian leadership. In Iran, the Revolutionary Guard and those close to it have stood as the greatest obstacle to an agreement, the journal has reported. The U.S. and Iran agreed last month to a 60-day period of negotiations to reach a final agreement. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion pages, America is more than a creed. We're a diverse people, but still a people, not a random aggregation of cosmopolitans. By Walter Russell Mead. The 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence found Americans, as usual, arguing about who the real Americans are and what it takes to be one. In the run-up to the celebration, your Global View columnists participated in two events where American identity was at the center of the discussion. One was a conversation with Professor Robert P. George at an event sponsored by the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. The other was a panel at the Aspen Ideas Festival with Monticello's president, Jane Kamensky, and David French of the New York Times, moderated by NPR's Jen White. At both events, I found myself politely pushing back against assertions that America is best understood as a creedal nation and that the Declaration is the definitive statement of the American creed. The Declaration is a weighty and world-altering document, but America is more complicated than a set of ideas. Whenever somebody tells me that America is a creedal nation, I think back to my own experience growing up in the Carolinas. Not once in my childhood or adolescence did I ever think of my American identity or anybody else's as creedal, nor did I meet anybody who thought this way. We were Americans not because we believed a set of ideas. We felt American the way Turks feel Turkish and the French feel French. That didn't mean I bought into what some today call heritage American identity. It was obvious even to a child that there was no single American race or ethnicity. The American South in the 1950s might not have been a global melting pot, but black people had been around as long as whites and were as American as anybody else. And somewhere north of Richmond, Virginia, where those mysterious other people called Yankees, very unlike us God-fearing and patriotic Southerners, but Americans all the same. Ricky Ricardo on I Love Lucy had an accent, but Ricky and Lucy were as American as Ozzie and Harriet Nelson. My American homeland was a complicated place with a lot of different kinds of people in it. When supporters of creedal nation theory come at me, brandishing copies of the Declaration, I respect their sentiments, but maintain my dissent. The Declaration isn't a set of propositions in political science issued by an academic committee. It was issued in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies. When in the course of human events, the Declaration reads, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, the existence of an American people was as self-evident to the founders as the principles the Declaration enumerates. When it came time to write the Constitution, it was we, the people, who established it. Since colonial times, the American people has been a tribe of tribes. American and Jewish identity follow similar paths. Judaism has its creeds and values, but the Jewish people are anything but a consensus-minded group of true believers. Homogeneity has never been the point. Arguing over the meaning of Jewish identity is a characteristic element of Jewish culture. Theodor Herzl, founder of modern Zionism, was an atheist who once proposed a mass conversion of Austrian Jews to Catholicism. But Herzl was a Jew all the same. American identity works along the same lines. There are creedal Americans, cultural Americans, Americans who embrace the country's diversity and complexity, and Americans who reject it. There are Americans who care as little for the principles of the Declaration as Herzl did for the Law of Moses, but American identity isn't reducible to political opinions. The whole point of the Civil War was that even after attempting to establish a rival nation based on the negation of the promise of equality in the Declaration, Jefferson Davis remained an American, like it or not. The American people can't be reduced to an ethnic folk bound by ties of blood and soil, nor are we simply a random aggregation of deracinated cosmopolitans connected only by a common adherence to a set of political ideas. We are a people. The mystic chords of memory that Abraham Lincoln invoked in his first inaugural address are real and they matter. 250 years ago, the founders expressed the aspirations of the American people in imperishable language. Today, American flourishing depends on our sense of common peoplehood, on our resolute defense of the ideas and institutions from which so many generations have derived so many blessings, and on the creative tension between these poles of our national life. A pluribus unum, we are one people with many roots. Long may we squabble over the meaning of America. The freedom to differ helps define who we are. Putin may see an opportunity to destroy NATO. Even a small incursion could doom the alliance if it lacks the political will to respond with force. By Gerard Baker. Beyond the familiar human melodrama that will unfold as President Trump meets European leaders at the North Atlantic Treaty Organization summit in Ankara, Turkey, this week, a question looms. Is Vladimir Putin about to attack a NATO member state? On its face, the idea seems preposterous. In his disastrous war on Ukraine, the Russian military has suffered 1.4 million casualties, a third of them killed in action. His economy is faltering as fuel and labor shortages and higher prices eat into his people's living standards. enemy drones are reaching deeper into his territory, causing damage and fear in similar proportions. He is mired in a struggle against a country with a population and a military a fraction the size of his own. Since the decision to launch that war has worked out so well, are we seriously being asked to believe that he would attack an alliance with an economy and military many times the size of his own? A month ago, I would have scoffed at the idea, but conversations with multiple senior European political, military, and intelligence figures in the past few weeks suggest to me the possibility is real and rising. For some Americans, including perhaps the president, the idea that Russia may take a shot at some feckless Europeans who have been notably unhelpful with America's military preoccupations in recent months might induce a yawn of indifference or even a smirk of schadenfreude. But the risks of any Russian provocation in Europe for America's global security are profound. Ukraine, a non-NATO member, is one thing. If we fail to respond to Russian aggression against a member of the alliance, NATO would become a dead letter. Which is why Mr. Putin might attack. As one intelligence analyst put it to me last week, his inspiration may be Marshal Ferdinand Foch, the general who commanded French forces at the Battle of the Marne in 1914. He famously reported, "My center is yielding, my right is retreating, situation excellent, I am attacking." A sudden show of unexpected force, just as he appears to be reeling from his ill-advised Ukraine war, could be to Mr. Putin's advantage. Although Mr. Trump's verbal shock treatment has jolted European NATO members into finally doing more in their own defense, they are still nowhere near ready for a defensive war. Government officials say it will be at least 5 years before their militaries are close to being capable of replacing U.S. capabilities in Europe. Mr. Trump has 2.5 years left in office. There is no guarantee his successor will have as skeptical an approach to NATO. If Mr. Putin chose the right targets, European leaders suspect Mr. Trump's administration wouldn't come to a NATO country's aid, fatally undermining the credibility of the alliance's collective defense commitment, and with it, NATO's existence, a dream outcome for Mr. Putin. His political needs might also be suited by an attack on NATO. A former British defense official said to me last week, "After 4 years of failure and rising popular discontent at home, he desperately needs a military victory. What better way to lift morale than to plant the Russian flag in some NATO field?" All this suggests we are now in a narrow window of opportunity for Russia to make a move. If Mr. Trump goes ahead with plans to cut European deployments, that window gets wider. Sure enough, intelligence reports point to rising risks of Russian action. Last week, a Polish news report said U.S. officials had warned Warsaw that Russia may attack the country. In an interview last month, a senior military figure from a NATO nation identified multiple risks, including a Russian seizure of islands in the Baltic and an incursion to assist the Russian minority in Estonia. None of these would amount to a full-scale invasion, but each would be enough of a provocation that if NATO failed to respond, its credibility would be in tatters. Is Europe really worth defending with U.S. blood and treasure? Is NATO still an essential strategic interest? I've long sympathized with the argument that a large U.S. commitment to the European theater is an anachronism in our security posture, a throwback to the 20th century geopolitics. China is obviously the biggest threat to U.S. security and leadership. Managing that relationship requires a shift of strategic resources and attention toward the Pacific. The Europeans can and should take care of their own freedom and security. But whether we want it or not, we are in a cold to simmering war with an axis of resistance that runs from Beijing through Tehran to Moscow. The U.S. is still dealing with the fallout of an inconclusive war with Iran that has left us militarily depleted. As we scramble to manage potential opportunistic moves by China's Xi Jinping in the Asia Pacific, Mr. Putin could deal a timely and fatal blow to an already weakened transatlantic alliance. That would be another hammer to the head of Western security and hegemony, and a dramatic enhancement of the power of Russia's alliance with China and our other adversaries. Perhaps all the talk of an imminent Russian attack is merely disinformation from European officials trying to keep President Trump from further weakening NATO. But if you were the American president, would you want to take that risk? You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Different parties, same folly. On tariffs, executive power, and artificial intelligence, they have the same bad ideas. By Andy Kessler. Comedian Adam Carolla has a routine about how the very wealthy and very poor do the same things. Some printable examples: never eat at an Outback steakhouse, take outdoor showers, have lunch with Bono, drive a maker of car that no longer exists. Annoyingly, it's the same for politicians. They all end up doing the same things. The horseshoe theory has become reality. The left and right, progressives and MAGA, bend around and almost touch. To me, it's more like a teething ring going round and round in a politician's mouth, with government power constantly biting down and inflicting pain on all of us. Or, as M.C. Escher, drawing with everything confusingly connected, I don't like it one bit. Who said this? Today, I'm announcing new tariffs in key sectors of the economy that are going to ensure that our workers are not held back by unfair trade practices. They include a 25% tariff on Chinese steel and aluminum products, a 100% tariff on electric vehicles made in China, a 25% tariff on electric vehicle batteries from China, and a 25% tariff on the critical minerals that make those batteries. Donald Trump? Nope. Joe Biden in May 2024. 11 months later, tariff man, Trump declared, effective at midnight, we will impose a 25% tariff on all foreign-made automobiles. Clang goes the horseshoe. Or this. In 2024, Mr. Biden complained of too many corporations in America ripping people off. Price gouging, junk fees, greedflation, shrinkflation. Mr. Trump recently wrote that customers are being gouged and that gasoline prices better start going down a lot faster than what I'm seeing. Same, same. A recent journal headline nailed it. Trump, like Biden, takes aim at big oil. Senator Bernie Sanders wants government to own 50% of artificial intelligence companies. Get in line, Bernie. In June, Vice President J.D. Vance said, "The president is supportive of the United States owning these big AI companies. OpenAI is considering giving up 5% to Washington." This on top of equity ownership in U.S. Steel, Intel, MP Materials, and that piece of NVIDIA's processor sales to China. Make it stop. Speaking of the vice president, my colleague Alicia Finley had a column in May titled J.D. Vance Courts Sean O'Brien and the Teamsters. What? He's got a lot more pandering to do, as Mr. Biden already declared himself the most pro-union president in American history. Presidential powers were expressly limited by the Constitution, or so we were led to believe. Remember Barack Obama's, "I've got a pen and I've got a phone." Not to be outdone, Mr. Trump last month, channeling Chevy Chase, declared, "I'm the president and you're not." Executive orders aren't laws. Only Congress can pass laws. But that hasn't stopped Democratic and Republican presidents from seizing power. See Mr. Biden's student loan forgiveness and Mr. Trump's birthright ban, both eventually declared illegal. Regulation is another urge presidents can't resist. The Biden administration put limits on AI chip export licenses. Mr. Trump continued the strict licensing requirement on high-end processors, but allowed exports of certain chips with a 25% tax. The Trump administration professes to be hands-off with AI. But Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth labeled Anthropic a supply chain risk, and the president is a yo-yo with on-again, off-again AI export controls. On Iran, Mr. Trump said Mr. Obama's Iran deal was one of the worst and dumbest agreements ever made by the U.S. Hard to argue. But on June 19th, Mr. Trump wrote, "His Iran deal will be far better." It doesn't seem much different. Yes, Democrats and Republicans have differences, often Venus and Mars-like, on taxes, free speech, oppression theories, and equity gobbledygook. But when it comes to family, they are often the same. They love their kids. Hunter Biden was paid $1 million a year by Ukraine's Burisma Holdings. He came with no discernible expertise beyond a father in a position of power. Now, a new mining deal for tungsten extraction in Kazakhstan reportedly may see both the Trump boys and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick's offspring positioned to extract their own benefits from the deal. Then add 10 held for H for the big guy. Hunter Biden admitted he is H and the big guy is Joe. In last week's revelation of the Trump family's $1.4 billion in crypto fees and gains in 2025, teething rings in action. It isn't only politicians. Left sympathizing Bill Maher of HBO fame recently said, "I want guns. Is he gunning for viewers on the right? A few more rich man, poor man lines. They're both outraged at the welfare system. They know the going rate for copper and live in houses made of recycled materials. I'd add both are always screaming on their phone in public. Here's what I would yell into my phone to politicians. Stop pandering to the identical extremes as your opponents. Do you have any principles? The Pepper and Salt cartoon shows two businessmen looking at a bicycle. And one says, consider yourself fortunate. Some employees don't have a company vehicle at all. Letter to the editor, my cab driver and America. Carl Rove's op-ed, Heritage Americans, an Un-American Idea, reminded me why I always sit in the front seat and talk with cab drivers. Years ago in Washington, my driver was a Kenyan immigrant. I noticed he drove entirely with hand controls. When I asked why, he smiled and said, I had polio as a child and can't use my legs. So when I bought a cab, I had to spend an extra $2,000 to have it adapted. There was no trace of self-pity, only gratitude for the opportunity to work in America. Mr. Rove's Nigerian cab driver and mine came from different countries, but share the same conviction. When I asked what America meant to him, he said, in America, if you work hard, you do well. From Patrick Henry, Torrance, California. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the July 7th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day or evening.
You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Volunteer radio readers broadcast daily readings, 24 hours a day of newspapers, magazines, books, and other printed matter to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. The Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service has broadcast almost 40 years of radio readings to those without sight. A broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio Reading Studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call 716-821-5555.